Welcome to the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important films and contemporary classics. My name is Chris and I am joined, as always, by my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we've got a special guest joining us for this episode. You've heard him before on previous episodes. What was the last one you did? I can't even remember.
I can't remember.
Our good friend Toby is joining us for this one.
Nice.
We just finished watching Sam Peckinpah's 1971 film, Straw Dogs.
Which both of you had seen previously.
Yeah. One of the reasons why I kind of thought it'd be nice to have Toby on for this episode is Toby and I met in film school and back in like 2005. And when one of the things that we kind of bonded over and became like friends over was... You were the only other person I knew that had seen this film and liked this film.
I think my mum showed it to me when I was a kid.
That's gnarly.
For some reason.
Yeah. That was like weirdly, I think, you and I kind of became friends because we were like, oh shit, you know this film? Great. And then from there, what else do you like? And friendship was born.
Pretty much.
Bonded over a love of rape.
I wouldn't say that. In that time, I become a bit of a fan of Sam Peckinpah. Yeah, I'd kind of rediscovered The Wild Bunch when I was like 17, 18, and like I still to this day really love that movie. And so like in that time period, I'd kind of gone on a bit of a kick watching all of his filmography, and this was one that kind of stood out to me because it's so drastically different from anything else he'd done, I think. I guess now's the perfect time to do plot synopsis.
I guess.
Toby, do you want to have a stab?
How can I put it lightly? It's a movie about a man and a woman.
Well said.
Who moved to her hometown in England, and they are immediately not liked by the townsfolk, and all hell breaks loose. I guess.
Yeah, that's like really the simple sentence logline.
Yeah, is like without trying to spoil it, I don't know.
We're on full spoiler territory.
All right, sweet. It's a movie where she gets raped and it turns into adult Home Alone.
Yeah, perfectly. Yeah, it's essentially
cause and effect.
Yeah, it's essentially a kind of a character study and an examination of the crumbling of a relationship. And the bounds that people can be pushed, but just housed within an exploitation film, I think. I think that's why I love it so much.
Yeah, I mean, the first two-thirds is a kind of film. And then the third act is just exploitation. I wasn't really prepared.
You know, it reminded me of a similar kind of one ages and ages ago, like in Double Digits time. Fiend Without a Face... Do you remember that, like, flying brain movie where it was just, like, so dull and then, like, the third act kicked in and there were all these floating brains on strings that attacked people?
Is that, like, that Futurama episode?
Kinda, yeah. And we were just like, oh, this just became awesome! Like, it goes from this very dull, dry sci-fi film into, like, exploitation! So
yeah,
I kinda got a vibe of that.
I adored this movie.
Mm.
I felt, I mean, you guys had seen it, I hadn't seen it.
Yeah.
And I had no idea, I didn't even know Dustin Hoffman was going to be in it.
Mm-hmm.
Until his head pops up.
Yep.
But going into the film, it's a, you know, a character drama about a couple that, I mean, they're both real fucking assholes.
Yeah, they're horrible people.
To the point where it's you can't get on anybody's side.
No.
Basically until the rape occurs. Basically, until these fellows that are helping, building a garage or some kind of extra house outside the back of Dustin's place start getting rapey.
Yeah.
That you go, okay, these two people are assholes, but, you know, nobody wants to get beaten up and raped.
Yeah. They start rapey and then they take those rapey vibes and act on them. I think, like, it just goes from... Yeah, into the full-blown, just reprehensible characters.
The whole town is creepy as fuck, man.
Yeah, it's the town of Wakely, but it's just really should just be Creepsville. Like, everyone's just kind of off-kilter a little bit, except for, like, maybe the Reverend and the law in the town is referred to as the Major. Major Scott.
The Major seems like the only normal kind of guy.
Yeah.
But in that regard, the first sequence really struck me as a kind of Western where you have the Major is the sheriff.
Yes.
And then you have a bunch of kind of rapscallion thugs that are kind of kicking about the younger ones. And then you have the town drunk. And there's always a kind of high tension that's going on between everybody in the pub, just like it was a Western film.
Mm.
Did you say that Peckinpah does Westerns? Or
Like, I mean, obviously his most famous one is The Wild Bunch, which is, if you've never seen that, is an awesome, awesome movie. And then I think right before this, he'd done The Ballad of Cable Hogue with Jason Robards.
Oh, cool.
He did Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. Like, yeah, he was... And he'd been making a lot of, like... He's kind of started as a TV director and then branched off into, like, the lower budget kind of in the studio system in the 50s, where it's just like, yeah, we just churn out a movie a week, kind of, you know. And he was one of those kind of hired gun directors that, before he kind of developed his own unique style as a filmmaker.
A kind of voice, if you want.
Yeah, yeah. There's not much of a... Like, there's somewhat of a fluidity between his work. Like, you can tell to some degree you're watching a Sam Peckinpah film. But not overly, I guess. Like, he's not necessarily an auteur director.
Yeah, okay. So, he's not like a P.T. Anderson, where you watch a P.T. Anderson film and you're like, oh, this is P.T. Anderson.
Wes Anderson as well. Wes Anderson. You know, all the Andersons.
Yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to bring up a point that is completely unrelated to this film.
Go.
I find that films from that era, they're kind of hard to define as a certain director, me personally, because they're all so similar, the way they're shot, the way they look. Barring, you know, subject matter, they all kind of look and feel the same from that kind of era. That's what I find.
Do you reckon that's like a limitation based on
technology?
Technology and budgetary.
Yeah. So it's really hard to distinguish style back then compared to, say, the 80s, the 90s, all that, or later 70s, you know, that kind of shit.
I will say, though. Sorry, please.
I'd say maybe with the exception of the European directors and maybe Kubrick.
Of course. I mean, there definitely is certain, like.
But for the most, yeah. I reckon you're
the general, like, rule, you know.
I will say that this film, it starts off really quite average in terms of cinematography, the way that it's shot, everything's kind of flat. But then what I thought was really interesting is the film goes, you know, through its motions. And David, who is the main character, Dustin Hoffman, kind of starts breaking down slowly, and his wife... start getting broken down, these flat shots become a bit more strange. You start having like points of view from very low down, then as soon as he actually does break, there's all the Dutch angles.
Yeah.
Which is nice to see a film where the Dutch angles are used so fucking well.
And properly. Used for a purpose of essentially showing that he, like, you know, his view on life is tilted and he's broken, like, yeah. With the way that fucked up angles are supposed to be. They're not just an excuse to, look at this cool shot. It's like, no, you're supposed to be telling a story with your visuals here.
Yeah, well, because he's kind of a coward and his wife is saying you're a fucking coward and so is she and all that sort of thing.
No, I think I interrupt Tom. You finish your point. No.
Well, I mean, that's the character arc, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
They're both trying to just put up with all of this crazy, creepy shit that's going on around them.
Yeah.
Until finally he's just like, no, fuck it. This is my house, my rules.
I've been pushed to a breaking point.
I need to boil some oil
and
prepare a bear trap.
Yes.
But I do think that it's not just like those, like Dustin, like that. To me, Dustin Hoffman and whatever her name is, that's the B story. That's not the actual movie. The movie is Niles and the farms people. They are the setting where it happens, and they're caught in between the main thing of.
So it's kind of to like, a good way to describe it is Hoffman is essentially the audience being thrown into this situation,
yes,
and kind of observing it, and then he is forced to act upon that situation, yes, as it's exactly, kind of thrust, throws it itself into his house, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's a cool way to look at it. I like that.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool.
Very cool. Very cool.
Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah, it's... I think, like, obviously, you're totally right. The way that Janice, the young girl, is kind of presented, like, the way that she's luring Niles, just as kind of, for lack of a better term, like, she's baiting him, essentially. Like, she knows that he's had these problems in the past, and she's like, well, let's just tease this out and see what happens. And then, to be honest, like, he kills her by accident because he's afraid, yeah, and he's, you know...
He doesn't know his own... He's got retard strength.
Yeah.
Sorry, I had to say that one.
Okay, yeah, that's I'll let that one slide. but, yeah, I think, like, that whole thing of how she essentially is presented as a temptress...
Mm.
It's just kind of furthering the representation of women in Peckinpah's films. Like, not to get on like a soapbox or anything here, but like he's very outspoken in his own words about how he has a disdain for women. So
it's like Werner Herzog and human beings.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah, it's like two peanut butter and jelly that make it go together. Sam Peckinpah, no women. Like. I was looking back on his IMDb, and I was just like, yeah, no women in that movie, no women in that movie, no women. Like, Wild Bunch has, like, one speaking female role, I think. Like, I think the only woman that gets...
played by Dude and Dre.
It's Ernest Ball guy. I think the only...
Andy Serkis.
Andy Serkis doing mocap. I think the only film where he has, like, an actual positive female... character is probably The Getaway. He did the original version of The Getaway with what's her name? Ally McGraw and Steve McQueen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a kind of positive female character, but everything else is kind of off on the side.
Well,
but
Janice is frustrated though. You know, she's not just a temptress.
Yeah.
She wants to be with David.
Yeah.
And is frustrated that she can't get David because David's just like, I'm not a pedophile, like, I'm not going to touch you.
Yeah.
So, in her frustration, she'll turn to whatever adult she can get.
Yeah, which is why she's also tempting with David. Yeah. Sorry, did you say David initially?
I said David.
Yeah, sorry,
that's the catalyst for her to go to
Niles. Yeah.
So, I think it's impeccable writing, man. Like, everything is really well set up and kind of everything is being funneled into a raid at a house. You know what I mean?
It's essentially setting up for adult Home Alone.
Yeah. Which is only, what, 20 minutes of the film?
Yeah, it's only 20 minutes.
It's like, fuck all.
Is it really only that much? It feels like it's so much longer, because it's so well made.
The movie goes 2 hours, it's probably the last 25, 30 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm.
And everything is just being shot down a barrel straight towards setting up a situation in a bumfuck nowhere town that is just like balls to the walls crazy where the major was shot dead.
Yeah.
You know.
I like the fact that for the first hour it seems like it's a nothing movie and nothing's actually happening in the movie.
It's essentially like the one
you get bored and you just like, why am I watching? Why am I sitting through this movie? And it's only up until the end of the second act when little things start to make sense and it's like, oh, okay, I understand. I'm starting to see the picture now.
What everything's building towards and the little steps towards it.
But I don't think, like, if you haven't seen this movie before and you don't know what the ending is and, you know, all that, I think that's pretty unpredictable and kind of, like...
Oh, yeah.
Unexpected, the level that it gets to. Like, the bear trap is a pretty great death scene.
But it's so perfectly set in, like, somewhat... It's in the first shot of the film, essentially. Like, it's them driving through town with a bear trap in the backseat of the car.
It's getting one of the dudes who gets killed. Isn't it the dude who gets killed by the bear trap?
Yeah, yeah, it's Charlie.
It's Charlie, yeah. He's the guy that he was carrying into the vehicle.
And sets it up, and yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is probably a long shot, but do you remember, like... Or have any inkling of, like, first time you kind of saw this and, like, when that third act happens, like, your reaction to it?
Nope.
No. Yeah, I mean, because I'm in that, like, ages, like, 15 years ago, or if not longer. So.
I haven't seen the movie in over 10 years, and I couldn't even remember most of it then. Ooh. I completely forgot about the whole Niles aspect of the movie.
Really?
Which
okay.
is the main point of the movie.
Yeah, essentially, yeah.
All I remember was the Home Alone aspect of it, and her getting raped.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is a really long scene, man.
It is long, but it's done so well, I think, in terms of... It's presenting, like, something really horrible on screen, but the way that it's cutting back and forth to Dustin Hoffman, like, a very oblivious character.
Yeah, I've got no issue with the length of the scene. I think
I have an issue with the length
of the movie, but not the length of that scene.
Yeah, there's a lot in the first act.
There's a lot of shit that could be cut from that film.
Oh, for sure.
And it's a lot of unnecessary, boring shit, so...
It's boring stuff in the essence of a character development.
It shouldn't be a 2-hour-long movie.
No. I think it's bloated because they're like, we're developing our characters and their relationships, but they've established that in the first 20 minutes of, these people are horrible and have a bad
brain. I also think it's the era of the film as well, and the way that shit was written back then. Like, I think that plays a big part in it too.
Just a kind of meandering narrative.
Yeah. Like, a lot of 70s films were like that. Like, the first act was just bullshit. Like, this 35-40 minute act could be said in 10-15 minutes. All the exposition, everything could be said in like that. Why keep going? But just the style of that time, I guess.
Yeah. You gonna battle?
Yeah, I got a battle. Sorry, guys.
So unfortunately, we started recording this a little bit late in the evening, and Toby could only stick around for a bit of it. But it was nice to have you on the episode. So any final thoughts on Straw Dogs before you leave?
Go watch Straw Dogs. You'll enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a good exploitation.
I wanted to say something witty, but I can't think of anything witty.
Just say something not witty.
Okay.
Yeah, cool.
Nailed it.
Straw Dogs is a good film. Dustin Hoffman is my baby's daddy.
See you, bud.
See you, guys.
Okay.
And on that note, there were two.
Yes. That was Toby. I want to talk about... the religious guy.
Yep, the reverend.
Yeah.
Yep.
I want to talk about how awesome... I mean, we just mentioned that the narrative is a bit meandering, but I still think that there's all these little setups that are just really impeccable. Like, they meet... David meets the Reverend. And before... Like, he arrives in the house, the Reverend's there to greet him, and he's ready to talk about, you know, getting some charity for the church and whatnot. You should be coming to the church, blah, blah, blah. And he really... the first thing he does is he puts on that really loud bagpipe music.
Yeah.
And it sets up this kind of... almost like a war cry... because he uses the same song
in
the house.
Interesting, yeah.
As a declaration of war, right?
Yeah.
But he also did basically the same thing with the Reverend, because David seems to be quite a staunch atheist.
Yes.
And the Reverend, you know, he's just telling the Reverend that your religion is crock shit. I'm going to put my war cry on because, you know, fuck you. You're in my house and it's my rules.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And I think it works, when I was saying, like, the meandering stuff, what I was more meaning about that is the first couple of, mainly the scenes in the house with Amy and David at the beginning were presented, like, 5 or 6 scenes of them just talking, like, him ignoring her wanting attention, and then it just ends with frustration. We have a little few too many of those, but the smaller interactions with the townsfolk are fantastic, and that's, like, the best example of it. And I think the great takeaway from that as well is from the scene with the Reverend is David in his own meekish kind of way is being combative against that guy, but he's kind of trading blows in a civilized manner. And then that scene ends later, like the very next scene, David's like, no, I like that guy.
Mm.
Like, because they were able to find a common ground and, like, you know,
it was a civilized battle.
It was a civilized battle versus the barbaric battle that happens later.
Yeah.
And why I think it's he can't... He's had the problem in the town of essentially relating to Charlie and all of those other guys is because he... I think David does not view them on his level, being able to kind of... Or he, spar
maybe,
like that.
Maybe he can't bring himself down to their level.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, yeah. He can't fathom them, him being on the same level as those guys, whereas now he's finally had an opportunity to do that, and it's...
But he's... I mean, his hand is forced, because when they're breaking through the windows and doors, and Amy is having her freak out, and
yeah.
She's just like, I'm going to get out of here, man, because, you know, like, I can just leave. You know, you can stay and defend the house if you want, but I'm leaving. He's just like,
I think no, that's ignorance on her behalf.
It sure is.
Yeah.
But no, because he understands. He's going, no, no, if they come in, we are dead.
Yeah, you don't understand. They've killed the lawyer.
They've killed the marshal. They're all murderers. We are now witnesses to this. We have to stay here and we have to kill them.
We have to survive. And, yeah. So we can...
So, I mean, his character has changed, but it's a forced state.
Yeah.
Which is fine. I think that's what makes it the most interesting is...
Do you... Forced? Obviously, to some degree, but I think it's...
He has to. He either does or and survives, or he dies.
Yeah, he essentially...
They would have killed him.
Yeah, I think there's a really nice quote from Peckinpah in the Criterion booklet, actually, like what he thinks about the film, and he refers to it as a film of four themes... A man ignorant of the violence inside himself.
Yeah.
I thought that's like pretty much like such a perfect example, like a summation of David as a character. It is. So that's why I'm wondering if it's like the it's forced in the sense of it draws it out of him, but it's something that has been brewing inside of him always, is I think what Peckinpah is kind of been hinting at with the film.
Well, he can't bring himself to confront these guys about, say, the cat being hung up in his closet.
Yeah.
And he suspects them.
Or the fact that they're slacking off and not really doing work, or they're essentially bullying him.
Oh, yeah, they're totally bullying him. Mm. But he can't confront them, and so what does he do? He has an anger in him that he just, it seems to manifest in a bickering and some kind of hatred towards his wife.
You're not... Like, I remember early on in this film, like, when we were sitting and watching it, you asked the question, is this, like, falling down? And you're not that wrong, actually.
Yeah, that's the Michael Douglas film where he gets out of the... I love it. He gets out of the car and he's just had fucking enough. He's in traffic. And he just goes on, like, the sweet spree of violence.
He goes into a McDonald's and it's, like, 1 minute after the breakfast menu and they won't give him a McMuffin. And
yeah, he's just had enough.
Yeah.
Everybody gets like that, but that's just a man that's just gotten to a breaking point and, you know, just does not give a shit about
society and its rules anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Rules.
Mm. Well, that's essentially what the arc that, like, to some degree, where David ends up, because he finds himself in the third act in a world where there is no rules anymore. Like, the situation he finds, like, the law is dead. And these men are going to come in and kill him. They're destroying his house. And it's... I love his little mantra of, I will not stand for violence against this house. It's so... He's trying to maintain his level of sophistication and civility, but it is just... Immediately he punctuates that by going and putting pots of oil to boil to throw on people's faces.
So, fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic. But what doesn't sit well with me is... what doesn't sit well with me is that he doesn't stand for the violence against his house, but the violence against his wife.
I think that's falling. I think I consider that to be put into the same category as his house, meaning like, you know, his life. That's how I like the old timing of like my house, I guess. Like that's how I view
my house and anything, anyone in it.
Yeah, the idea of house being like, you know, your possessions, your family. Like that's how I've kind of always construed it.
I correct me if I'm wrong, but I was expecting to see, and maybe this happened, I missed it, but I was expecting him to explicitly have, like, explicitly say, or she to say to him that I was raped and, like, you know, I'm kind of...
No, it's never explicitly said.
So, and
it's
he, just and he,
viewed upon.
And we were saying, oh, he must kind of be getting it. He must
fully gets it at that point.
Okay, so, but he never explicitly goes, like, I'm going to fucking, like, get these guys for you, man.
Yeah, no.
So...
And it's, and she never comes out and says, I was essentially gang raped by these guys, yeah, and you need to do something about it. Like, he just understands that something happened and she's having a really hard time, and that's when he, you start to see him come out as an actual decent person, and, you know, he sees that she's visibly upset at the church social, and so he gets her out of that situation, and then in the car ride he's asking, is there something I can do? Like, what, how, tell me how I can help. Like, what can I do for you? Unfortunately, it's only like those kind of two or three scenes.
That's enough.
But it's important that they happen right before the explosion kind of happens and the breaking point.
I think you're right. That's really all you need, just those two little sequences. And then you can all of a sudden just jump in onto the phone. But I still think maybe it's like a Peckinpah thing where it's like, she's just a woman, don't worry about it.
Yeah, essentially.
And so they don't explicitly go, like, I'm fighting for the house, but really I'm fighting for you, because who gives a fuck about the house? He's really, I would have thought that the house is the bubble of the family unit.
Yeah.
If you want to call it that or whatever.
It needs to be, I'm fighting for you and I to survive. But the way that Peckinpah presents that is him grabbing her by the hair and slapping her and telling her to sit down and be quiet.
Yes, that's true. Well, in a way, he is saying, like, no, you have to stay with me. But he just does it in a really
violent, aggressive way. Yeah. I've never seen it, but this film was actually remade probably about 6 years ago or so. And I never brought myself to watch it because I was like, that's just...
Well, who made that film?
I can't... I'll look it up now. Yeah. I know who the cast is. So the role of Amy, the wife, the Susan George role in this film, it's... what's her name? Kate Bosworth. that lady. And
I need to see her face, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Not as good as you with the whole... You know.
She was in Blue Crush, that horrible surfing movie. She was in Superman Returns. She was Lois Lane. That lady...
Oh, she's not very good.
Not great. And James Marsden played David. I really like James Marsden. Cyclops. OG Cyclops.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That guy's great. Yeah. He's funny. yeah, it's... Oh, and I just saw that Tom, like, the angry drunk guy who, like, you know, his daughter goes missing was James Woods. Ugh. But I... After rewatching the original, I'm, dare I say, kind of tempted to see how they handle the Peckinpah aspects of it all. Like, if Amy is a more well-rounded character, if there is just an overwhelming disdain for women in the film, like...
Surely not.
That's what I'm intrigued to see.
The film would bomb if you fucking...
Yeah.
...expected it to go to a mainstream market...
Yeah.
...successfully... And you had that much to stay.
Have your protagonist slapping his wife and being like, you sit in the corner and be quiet.
Yeah, you can't have, like, I'm sorry, but you can't have...
No, I'm agreeing with you totally.
Oh, no. I'm saying sorry. I'm saying I'm sorry to Peckinpah.
Okay, yeah.
You can't have your main character, like the hero of the film, slap the woman that just got raped by the people that aren't the heroes.
Yeah.
And expect that everything's like, yeah, it's all good. He's still the hero. So, no, he's, like, nearly on the level of the rape then.
Do you think on that kind of note, do you think the film would work just as well without having... Like, essentially that... Like, we're just flat out discussing that moment where Hoffman... Where Amy goes to leave and he grabs her and throws her down. Without that moment, do you think the film works just as well? Like,
you do need to have
him be fully snapped.
Well, to me, that's like his. That's as much as I can get of an explicit. You're part of this, and I need you, and I'm fighting for you. Moment. So you do need
No, no, but I'm talking about, like, the moment where he slaps her across the face and it's just like, don't you fucking...
Oh, he's broken?
Yeah. Like, that I think, to me, like, is telegraphing. He has snapped and will do whatever. He's just fighting for his own survival at this point. Like, it doesn't matter about her necessarily. So that kind of, like... I think I'm just viewing the film with a modern eye and just being like, you don't need to do that.
Yeah, I think maybe like Peckinpah's fucking like feelings towards women are getting in the way of us being modern people.
Yeah,
but I still think that I still really enjoy, even if you put aside all of the kind of hatred towards women stuff. I still really enjoy the character arc of Dustin Hoffman.
It's great, yeah. It's such a simple arc as well, and Hoffman nails it, I think.
He's a bit of a weird guy. Like, he's almost a weird choice for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because...
it's unexpected.
He does the kind of make well.
He does the mathematician.
Yeah.
Yeah, well...
And he even... No, he was really great.
He nails it. It's...
I was going to say that he... Like, I did... I'm not sure if I really dug his kind of maniac portrayal at the end, like, during the end sequence.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's really quite measured.
It is.
And almost, like, business-like, you know?
Which is, like, adds to the kind of further elements of him having...
A crazy...
Having really gone to this dark place.
Yeah.
It's kind of... pains me to say, given recent stuff, but Dustin Hoffman has kind of always been my favourite actor, which is really unfortunate now.
I thought it's all alleged with him.
Well,
it's like,
no, it's not.
Full on.
Yeah.
Oh, that sucks.
No, yeah. So that's kind of... putting that aside, separating the man from his art that he presents, he is a phenomenal actor. As a human being? I don't know. but yeah, he... So, I think as well, like, that's probably one of the reasons why I discovered this film early was because I just...
You like Dustin
Hoffman. I love Dustin Hoffman films. Him as an actor. This is coming off... This is like 2 years after Midnight Cowboy. Which is... So this is about 4 or 5 years up postgraduate, which is kind of obviously the big film that kind of made him... Dustin Hoffman and made him a superstar.
Mm.
So this was kind of in that period where he could do whatever he wanted, and so it's kind of an interesting choice for him to go and do this one. Kind of go over to England and make this really fucking weird exploitation movie.
did they just write him in? It's just like, oh, he's just an American. I mean, he has to be an outsider.
I think it works, and then casting an American actor, A, gives it... you know, star appeal, and then, you know, adds that further outsider element to the story.
Yeah, it's good. It's really, really, really good film.
Yeah. Anything else you want to kind of chime in on before we jump into trivia?
No.
No?
No, I don't think so. I can't really think of anything else.
Mm.
I didn't do notes this time.
Yeah.
Because we were watching with Toby and stuff.
Yeah.
And, that's not really... doesn't really explain why I didn't write notes down, but I didn't.
I wrote one note, and it reads, "This film is just Godard's Contempt, but by an exploitation director." I think I wrote that in, like, the first, like, hour of the film, where it's just essentially in one location of a house and a couple bickering. Like, an hour. I'm like, oh yeah.
It's not a bad call.
Reminds me of Contempt. So we'll jump into trivia on the film. It was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Score for Jerry Fielding, the composer. It's not memorable.
Where's the score? I can't even remember the score.
Exactly, really. Yeah. So it's... okay.
I'll tell you what was really sick. There was the rat catcher guy. He's making all these noises.
Yes.
This giggling and...
the bike horn.
The bike horn, yeah. It's almost like... like the Warriors or fucking Clockwork Orange level.
Okay.
Kind of sound like they're not sound effects because they're part of the they're part of the proceedings of the scene.
Yeah.
But they have this really weird, surreal quality to them.
Mm.
I mean, he's even got that nose. It's very clockworky.
It really reminds me of Clockwork. And then the opening scene, where you first meet them, I kind of pointed out they look like they're dressed like the rival gang they come across in the theater, like all in that weird army kind of getup. And yeah. Weirdly, Clockwork came out the same year.
Okay, so they're completely independent, really.
Yeah, but just like these weird little
yeah
random things that are kind of similar.
That's interesting. Mm. I think those noises will be way more memorable than the soundtrack for me.
Yeah. Before shooting, Sam Peckinpah instructed Dustin Hoffman and Susan George to live together for 2 weeks with screenwriter David Zeller Goodman in tow. Some of their interactions during this period were taken and worked into the film script. So they didn't really get along. So that's kind of helped, I guess.
Live together for 2 weeks.
Yeah. In the scene where Dustin Hoffman's character first enters the local pub, when he's first going in to buy cigarettes and things, Peckinpah was unhappy with how the other actors reacted to the stranger entering their world. Eventually, he decided to do one take where Hoffman entered the scene without his trousers on. He got his reaction and those are all the shots used in the film. And because I knew that in advance, I noticed there's the shot of Tom sitting at the bar, and he like looks over to see him, and then he kind of goes wide-eyed. And if you look at his eyes, he darts down and then back up.
I noticed that.
So it kind of works as the way of like sizing someone up, but knowing that behind the scenes Hoffman had no pants on, you're like, that is genius.
But they, in the film, it does come to a shot of his shoes and then draws up, right?
Exactly. So they've kind of countered that with the coverage on Hoffman to make it kind of work well.
I remember that because it does the shot of the sneakers,
yes,
and the pants, and I'm like, yeah. I really wouldn't have that reaction to a man in sneakers and pants.
No.
Or jeans, or, you know, sneens.
But then, like, the justification of why those reactions were what they were is...
Was it, like, his dick out level or just underpantsy thing?
I think underpants. I wouldn't imagine Hoffman to be a balls-out guy.
Yeah, maybe. I think he would.
It depends how method he's going.
Have you heard the news?
What news?
Oh, you know, like that he's kind of...
Just a creep.
He's a creep, right?
Yeah. We kind of brought this up, I kind of brought this up when we were watching the film, actually. Cole sat and watched it with us. I was really hoping she'd sit down and stick around for the podcast, but she was not,
No, she was, yeah. I mean, about 10 minutes into the film, I thought, like, man, it's going to be rape.
You just got a vibe.
I got this really rapey vibe. It was strong.
Which means Peckinpah did his job, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, so I think, was it Toby that mentioned that it's boring a little bit at the start? I wasn't bored because I was thinking, like, fucking the rape vibes are very, very full on. Even, like, straight from the get-go, man.
Well, I mean, shit, the first shot of Amy is a close-up on her boobs as she's walking without a bra. Like, that's our introduction to our female lead character.
Yeah, and the first time you see the guy that will eventually rape her, he's staring down David.
Yeah.
It's a really sick shot. I think it's like he puts the hood down of the car and his eyes are just like staring this guy down, going like, I'm gonna take your woman.
Yeah.
And there's a sick quote in it that's like, you know, if you can't catch him, shoot him. They're referring to the ducks, but they're also really referring to the women.
Oh, nice catch.
Yeah, so anyway, we were talking about... something. What were you talking about?
I was talking about where the title came from. But, like, that kind of led in from, like, Cole was wondering.
Oh, yeah, we were watching
it. I really wish she could have stuck around. It was intrigued to see her kind of comments, like, once we hit the end of the film.
Like, she wasn't liking it. But then she did, especially the rape scene. Oof.
Yeah.
But then she did enjoy the retribution.
I mean, it's not an easy film to watch, really. Like, there's a lot of unpleasantness in there. But then, once it goes full exploitation at the end, you can kind of get some fun out of
it. It is fun. Like,
yeah.
It's fun.
At that point, it's just drag you through so much hell with these characters that you just need to be like, You're getting the catharsis that David himself is getting at that point, almost.
That's exactly right.
So anyway, back to the point. The title, Straw Dogs, comes from a Chinese philosopher, Lao Tzu, who wrote, "Heaven and earth are not humane, and regard the people as straw dogs." Straw dogs were used as ceremonial objects for religious sacrifice in ancient China.
Good heavens.
Yeah, so that's where they got the title.
So she's the straw dog?
I guess.
The sacrifice?
I'm imagining.
Sacrifice for what? Oh, God.
I think it's more than just the idea of, you know, heaven and earth not being humane.
Okay.
Like, it, you know, it's just a horrible world, kind of, and that's what this film's kind of presenting.
Yeah.
I got a whole bunch of alternates here, people that were considered for the role of David instead of Dustin Hoffman. We had Beau Bridges, not Jeff. His brother, Stacey Keach, Jack Nicholson, and this one's interesting, Sidney Poitier.
Oh, really?
That would have.
That's weird, yeah.
That would have added a new element of the English townsfolk being real upset about him being there.
No, I'm really glad it was Dustin, star of Hook.
Yeah. And for the role of Amy, there was Judy Geeson, Jacqueline Bisset, Diana Rigg, Helen Mirren, Carol White, Charlotte Rampling, Judy Huxtable, and Hayley Mills.
Is there anyone of note other than Helen Mirren?
Yeah, Diana Rigg.
Who's she?
Jacqueline Bisset. Diana Rigg was TV show Avengers, like the British Avengers, like not Marvel superhero Avengers. I think Emma Peel's the character's name. She was a Bond girl as well. Never mind. Tom's staring at me blankly.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Jacqueline Bisset, she was in The Deep. That Peter Benchley movie. Anyway, Anthony Hopkins was also considered for a major role. It doesn't specify which. I'm guessing probably the Reverend.
He would have done a good major.
Because 71... Hey, 71 is too young.
Oh, yeah.
71 is like...
I always think of him as like the really old guy.
Yeah, you just think
forever,
of...
Forever, you know?
Yeah, because even if you look back at Silence of the Lambs, like...
He's still...
Which is 20 years post this.
Yeah.
He's like in his mid-40s. Like, he's not like... So he would have been... Maybe Charlie, even, the rapist. Like, the head of the local guys. But he wouldn't have worked for that, I don't think.
No.
Peckinpah wanted Richard Harris or Peter O'Toole. So Richard Harris was original Dumbledore and English Bob from Unforgiven.
Mm-hmm.
Or Peter O'Toole for the role of Charlie. Yeah, so that kind of works out well with the Anthony Hopkins frame, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah. No, the guy that did it was great, I thought.
Yeah, he was creepy.
Yeah. I think if it was Richard Harris or Peter... If it was Peter O'Toole... He's too big at that point. Like, that would just take you out of it really dramatically.
And too drunk.
Yeah. the future of the film was put in jeopardy. The future of the film was put in jeopardy when director Sam Peckinpah caught pneumonia after an all-night drinking session with Ken Hutchison in the sea at Land's End. Having recuperated at a clinic in London, Peckinpah was only reinstated after promising he would remain sober for the remainder of the shoot.
He sounds like a really full-on eccentric guy.
Yeah, there's the Criterion David Ian Blu-ray has a documentary about him, and it's fascinating. Like, he's a gnarly guy.
Were you saying that there's footage of him?
That's how the documentary opens. It's him pacing back and forth, like throwing a knife into the wall in the set.
Yeah, okay.
He's a gnarly dude.
Mm.
This was Sam Peckinpah's first non-Western and his first film shot outside of the US. So yeah, that's why I think a lot of the tropes of Western cinema end up kind of bleeding in, and you kind of got those vibes.
Mm.
Yeah. It's interesting to note, I didn't have it in the trivia, but the film got banned in the UK for a very long time, actually.
Did they think it was senseless? Is that why?
No, it's just very full on, I think. It got kind of caught up in...
The rape... I guess the rape thing...
When it first came out, it was rated X. Yeah. And then when the home video market became a thing... you know, so it was X when it was in theatres. And then when it was all of a sudden you can have it at home on home video and things... Things need to go through re-rating process, and it was like, no, you don't need this. So it got banned in the UK. That got revoked probably, you know, 15 years ago or so? 15, 20 years ago?
I guess, what's its equivalent to today? I reckon, like, you know, your grindhouse kind of films.
Yeah, I think
Death Proof, it's a bit like the Death Proofy kind of thing.
No, because that's tongue-in-cheek.
That's tongue-in-cheek, yeah. But I feel like the fucking, like, ending is almost tongue-in-cheek. The Home Alone stuff.
Oh, for sure. But then up until then, it's like, the rape scene is very full-on.
Okay, yeah. It's a bit more artistic than Death Proof.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm. But that's its...
But then if you watch the film to its end, what do you come away with? You come away with, like, fuck, that was sweet Bear Trap. as opposed to, like fuck, I was really depressed when I was watching 20 minutes of a rape scene.
Yeah. It's not necessarily... It's not gratuitous, and it's not for the sake of, you know, exploitation, like which
is
bad.
It kind of is,
like, given that it's...
It kind of is.
Yeah, I keep calling this film an exploitation film, and because I reckon it totally is. It's just my opinion. And that's, like, I think the easiest way to kind of view and dissect the film is...
Is that too big of a discussion to get into right now?
Probably, yeah. So, yeah. I don't know, I just really like this movie.
Yeah,
I think
too.
It's a great one.
Well, what's an exploitation film then, if this isn't one?
What is?
Yeah.
Oh, like, zombie chainsaw hookers.
Okay. Like, really
like
tongue-in-cheek.
Like, this is a very high-end exploitation film, I think.
Yeah, okay.
Like, I just wanted to clarify, like, in case, you know, listeners are sitting there just being like, oh, no, it's like, no, I think, you know, they can be both. Like, you can have an art film and a very well-made film be in the exploitation kind of genre, I guess, but, I mean, like, another example is, like, Basic Instinct's an exploitation film, and that's really fun to watch. Like, it's a good movie.
Yeah.
Wild Things as well is a great exploitation
movie.
Yeah,
there is definitely 5 minutes that it's fun.
How often do you forget, like, do you forget Bill Murray is in Wild Things?
Yes. Yes, I did.
I love just bringing that up to people. They're just like, wait, what? Oh, yeah. Because you don't think of him when you think of that movie.
No, I don't.
On that note, I guess that'll probably wrap us up looking at Sam Peckinpah's Straw Dogs. We will be back in a fortnight's time when we look at Robert Bresson's this is so much. No, I always pronounce them. I want to get you to see how you can pronounce the French here.
Les Dames du Bois de la Bois. No. Les Dames?
Les Dames?
Les Dames du Bois de Boulogne.
That's our next film.
By Robert Bresson.
Yep.
1945, France. Do you know anything about this film?
Absolutely nothing.
Looks intense. Alright.
Yeah, so, tune in for that. But otherwise, if you have any comments, queries, we'd love to hear from you, so feel free to send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter at Criterion Quest, or on Facebook by searching The Criterion Quest. But otherwise, that'll wrap us up for this week's episode. I'm Chris.
And I'm Tom. See you next time.